This is the ODG Apparel Podcast.
Wait, I'm not understanding. Why does an apparel company have a podcast, though?
Because they're that awesome.
What's up, guys? Dave with ODG Apparel. On this episode, we have CJ Quartelbaum chatting with us just about his life and following Jesus and kind of his ministry. He's a writer. He's a speaker. We have a really, really fun conversation and just a really encouraging conversation. I hope it pushes you towards Jesus. Give it a listen. Let us know what you think. Review it. All those different things. Enjoy. All right, guys. Dave with ODG Apparel. We have another long-form conversational podcast. We have on this episode, CJ Quartelbaum. I'm hoping I pronounced your last name right. CJ, how's it going?
You got it. I'm doing well, man. How's everything for you?
It's good. It's hot here in Florida, so I don't know what the weather's like in Brooklyn, but it's definitely like 95 right now and crazy hot. I feel like it's seeping 95. Into my walls, and I can't even breathe.
As a person who is uncomfortable in anything under 85, I'm jealous right now. It's actually cold and warm in Brooklyn today.
Wow. Usually people hear 95, and they're like, that's a little too high, but man, that's... Hey, if that, all the power to you if you're into it. This is the year to kind of like be totally like off topic, but this is the year for me where I'm not going to complain about the heat because I complain about winter and the heat. So it's like sooner or later, I got to just pick one and not complain. Like I got to just enjoy one of them. Otherwise, I just complain all the time.
I mean, you get fall and spring. That's the perfect weather.
I know. But not in Florida, though. It's just hot. It's just hot or rainy. It's one or the other. So we lose either way, but also win at the same time. We have the beach, so I'll take it. CJ, so we don't know each other, but we have kind of a mutual friend. So introduce yourself, kind of let us know, people listening, kind of who you are and what you're about.
So I'm CJ from Brooklyn, born and raised. I'm a writer, speaker, avid hoops fan. Just a regular guy trying to make the gospel known out here. I got an undergrad in finance, and then I went to seminary because I decided being in finance was not the way for me. And now the Lord has me on this wonderful, fantastical journey where I don't exactly know where I'm going or what I'm doing, but he is faithful. I just try to trust that.
So what practically are you doing right now in Brooklyn? Like, do you have a specific, I noticed on your website that you do, it looks like you do speaking engagements, you write, you're all over the internet with different writing and blogs and whatnot, but are you also, if I'm not mistaken, it looks like you're a staff at a church as well?
Yeah. So my main thing is writing and speaking. That's my warehouse. That's what I love. But I also, and I'm a deacon at my church, Apostles Brooklyn. I used to be on staff, but I actually just came off. And then my full-time job is working for a short-term missions organization, helping to lead short-term mission trips in New York City.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. And so are those short-term mission trips, you said, into New York City or people out of New York City to other places?
Into New York City. So I get a bunch of high school and college students doing week-long trips here all summer.
Wow, that's awesome. So walk me through kind of the heart behind that ministry and kind of what you guys are trying to accomplish with it.
Yeah, so the heart behind it is it's simply to make Jesus known. I think what happens is you have a lot of people, and this is, you know, largely my clientele. You have a lot of people from the suburbs who they look around their neighborhoods, they look around their areas, and they don't see the depth of need that's there because it's not the same. And so they want to come to the city and they want to meet some physical needs. And so they come here and they get to meet physical needs. They get to go to soup kitchens. They get to work at some churches. They get to do a wide variety of projects. But I always try to press on them that you have needs back home. And just because people are financially secure, that doesn't mean that there isn't a need still there. As a city apologist, as a Brooklyn lover, I always say the suburbs are just as dark and violent of a place. It just looks different. So if you come on a trip here and you think that the only need is here, then you have to open your eyes to the world around you.
That's good. And so to kind of be like a little bit of a, to kind of open up a can of worms, I guess, I know there's always talk in the church as to like the value of short-term and long-term missions and all that kind of stuff. And the things that we've done well in the church, the things we've done poorly. So obviously you believe in short-term missions, right? You're a part of that. But is that something that you guys are thinking about as a staff of like, how can we do this well? Because I know that there's people who've done it poorly and you kind of feel like you're this savior complex of like, look at me, I'm going to come and save the city for 6 days that I'm there, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, is that something that you guys are thinking about? And how do you guys navigate that and really make sure that that's not what's happening in some of these people's minds?
So when our groups first get here, we're hammering the gospel home to them. We're hammering truth about this city right into them the moment they walk in the doors. I just straight up tell them, you are not here to save this city. I know because of TV and media, you think New York is a godless place, but there are 6,000 churches here. There are gospel movements all around this city. There are hundreds of churches being planted. There are church planting organizations headquartered here. Jesus is here, and he's doing work. You're coming in to help, but you have no ability to save. Because if you did, then I think you would have saved the area that you're in already.
That's really good. Yeah, because otherwise, yeah, like you said, there wouldn't be this kind of blindness to the fact that your area needs the gospel just as much. It just looks different, like you said. Yeah, that's really cool. So walk me through kind of what's your story to faith? How did you kind of come to know Jesus and go from, how did you end up here where you're at today?
Man, so I tell the story often. It takes me about 13 minutes, but for the sake of the podcast, I'm going to give you the most condensed version I can.
Hey, you have CJ. You got all 13 minutes if you want it. We're ready.
Oh, no, I'm not going to do that to you. But I grew up going to church, grew up in what I like to call a quasi-Christian home. We went to church. We talked about prayer. We talked about Jesus, but there wasn't really much gospel in the house. I don't recall any times where we ever prayed together as a family, where we ever walked through scripture together as a family. But I always recall my mother sending us to church, always telling her we need to put our hope and trust in Jesus. There was never really much why there. And then I get to church and it was very much the same. My church was full of immigrants. My mother's from the island.
Hey, CJ, not to interrupt you, but just as a pressing question for some of the listeners who might be thinking it. There might be people on the podcast thinking, but CJ, I think I grew up in the same household, but how do I know the difference? Like, you talked about there was no gospel there. So kind of, do you mind explaining what you mean with that? Because I think that that's something that it's really easy to miss. I think how powerful what you're saying is. You're saying you grew up in a Christian home, but there was something deeply missing and not there about it. So kind of what practically do you think that that is?
Oh, I see. Yeah, so that's actually where I was leading. So
okay, perfect.
The church that I grew up in, it was a mostly an immigrant church. My mother's from this island off the coast of South America called Trinidad. Beautiful little place. Mm. Most of the people in the church were from Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, one of the islands. And it's kind of the story of the missionary who goes in and shares the gospel with a group of people. And the people, they know the gospel, they love the gospel, they believe it. And when it comes to their kids, it's assumed that their kids know the gospel. So the kids don't get the gospel. They get the implications of the gospel. They get the do's and the don'ts. Do this, don't do this, live this way, don't live this way. This is right, this is wrong. And by the time you get to the third generation, they hate the gospel. They want nothing to do with it because they have no relationship to it. All they have are rules and regulations. All they have are, it's the stringent law. And I think we were in that second place where it was, I guess, because we assumed our parents knew the gospel, we could move on from that. So you just get all the do's and don'ts. But do's and don'ts don't work past the third grade. We need to know why. And growing up there, we never really got the why. In addition to that, I was very much taught that Christianity was kind of like a light bulb. It's like a light switch. You turn it on and off when you're ready. So when I was 13, I decided I was ready. I said, you know what? I'm 13, I'm a man now, because at 13, we think we're men. We get a little hair on our upper lips, we start to smell a little funky, we think we're men. So I said, Mom, I want to get baptized, because that's what Christians do, that's what men do. So my church puts me through a membership class, I get baptized, and I go to school the next day, and everyone's recounting their weekends, and they ask me, what'd you do this weekend? I was like, oh, I got baptized. And the immediate response was, oh, CJ's a church boy, and that, I guess you could call that my first taste of persecution. Everybody went to church. If you're black, you grew up in church. Every black person got a praying grandmother. So the idea that I was ridiculed for going to church was weird, but I didn't like it. And so in that moment, I said to myself, you know what? I'll be a Christian after high school. So college comes. And in college, I remember I went to a school where I didn't know anybody. And I'm walking down the hall. I'm moving in, I'm seeing all these people, and I'm thinking to myself, all right, I'm really going to be on fire for Jesus. I'm going to convert all these people. They're going to be Christians by the time I leave here. And my first night there, I get a knock on my door. Now, I don't know anyone there. So I told my roommate, hey, you need to go answer that because it must be for you. So he answers the door and he comes back and he says, actually, it's for you. And there's this girl standing at the door and she looks at me and she goes, hey, I saw you moving in with your mom earlier. And I just wanted to tell you, you take my breath away. It was in that moment I said, well, I can't be a Christian now. Now's not the time. I got to wait till after college.
Now's not the time.
Yeah. So I get a girlfriend, not her because she scared me. And this girlfriend, classic teenage heartbreak. You know, she cheats on me, treats me poorly, lies to me, all these things. And like any foolish 18-year-old, I said to myself, I have to get her back. I just have to. So we're on the phone one day and she says, and I asked her, I said, what does Josh have? Josh was Nubu. I said, what does Josh have that I don't? She's like, well, he's a Christian and he's helping me change. And I'm like, well, I'm a Christian too. I grew up in church. I'm trying to change. And then she says to me, but I can't tell, and hangs up the phone. And so she hangs up the phone and I'm sitting there in the dark and I'm like, man, I know right from wrong. I know what I'm supposed to do. I should be living for God. You know what? That's it. I'm going to do it. Not for her, but because this is what I'm supposed to do. And so, again, I think I'm flipping the light switch on, but there's no change in my heart. So the next 3 years of college for me were me. I was doing whatever I wanted to do, but then also doing Christian things. And whatever sins I had going on in my life, I would just say I was struggling with that. But I checked all the boxes. I stopped cursing. I wasn't a big drinker anyway, so that wasn't a big deal. I wasn't a big partier, so it was easy to stop that. I stopped stealing. I fit a lot of the external measures, and any other sins that I had going on in my life, I was just struggling with that. So it was okay because I was listening to Christian music on the side and I was going to church once every couple of months and I was reading my Bible every so often. And the thing about that is it's easy to be puffed up with head knowledge. I grew up in a church where you did all of the church activities. I sang in the choir. We did vacation Bible school. We had this thing called Bible quizzing. At one point, I had the entire book of Ephesians memorized. So it was easy for me to read the Bible and retain knowledge. I remember arguing in college with a Seventh-day Adventist pastor about why it's okay for us to eat shellfish. And in the end of the conversation, he goes, look, you're right, but this is the denomination that pays my bills, so I'm not going to have shellfish. And that was like a big moment of pride for me, but my life was awful. I was nowhere near Jesus, but I was puffed up with all this knowledge. So after college, I moved back to New York, and I show up at my youth group, and I'm like, all right, this is it. This is for real. I'm really going to do it this time. But it was just all the same things. But at the time, I started writing poetry. When I was 13, and this is just the Lord's providence and how he's really funny. When I was 13, my mother said to me, you're not going to lay around my house all day and do nothing. So on a Saturday morning, which should have been my day off because I'm in school all week, but that's another story. She ends up putting me in these writing classes and I start writing poetry there. I stopped for a few years, but for whatever reason, I picked it back up in college. And so coming home, I said, you know what? Christians do Christian things. And I write poetry, so I should write Christian poetry. So I write this poem called Elevate, which is the worst thing I've ever written, but I keep it around to remind me of how bad I can be at things. But I said, you know what? I'm gonna give it another try. So I write this poem called I'm a Christian, and I do it for my youth group. I don't think much of it, but the pastor of the church loved it. So he says to me, hey, you should do that on Sunday. I'm like, sure, why not? I do it on Sunday. The church goes crazy. Now, in New York, growing up in the denomination I grew up in, we had a bunch of sister churches around the city. So we all, every 6 weeks or so, had these youth rallies where all the churches came together. So my cousin Kev says to me, CJ, while you were away at college, I became a rapper. And I think you should put your poem with my song and we should make a group. So I said, sure, why not? This is how Wordplay was born. And if you search iTunes, you might still be able to find some of our music. It was really bad, but the Lord used it to do good things. So we become Wordplay and we do our church's youth rally. And there were, I think it was probably about 1,000 people there. And people go nuts. And so now we're like, oh, let's do this for real. And now we are, it was probably a year straight where we were booked every Friday and Saturday night to be at some church or some event doing spoken word and rapping. The problem with that was I was living one life on stage, telling you to follow Jesus, mm-hmm. and living a completely different life off stage. But spoken word.
And you're how old at this time, CJ?
At that time, I'm 21, so I just graduated college.
Okay.
But the Lord would use that crooked line to draw straight in my life. He would use spoken word to bring me to Him. I end up at a church going to do sound check. And as I'm sitting in sound check, this guy walks up to me and he goes, "Hey, have you ever heard of Pastor Eric Mason?" I'm like, yeah. He's got some church out in Philly, right? He's like, yeah, he's having a conference and I think you should go. I'm like, well, you know what? Christians go to Christian conferences. Why not? At this point, I'm a spoken word artist. I've ascended to the role of youth leader at my church. I'm really involved, but I'm still living this really ugly, horrible life off stage. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go because I can take all the stuff that I'm going to learn here and I can bring it back to my church. Now, I tried to get a bunch of people to go with me. No one wanted to go. And in a very uncharacteristic move at the time, I went by myself. And I was driving from Brooklyn to Philly. It's about a 2-hour drive. And this is before the days of turn-by-turn GPS. I had the printed Yahoo Maps directions to get me there. Got lost.
That were like written in a foreign language.
Yeah. Got lost twice, but still made it on time. So it's the Frequency Conference, April 10th, 2010. A day that will forever live in my memory. So I walk in and, you know, memory is a fuzzy thing. This is how I remember it. I would actually love to talk to Eric Mason to see if this fact checks. But I walk in and I'm walking down the aisle and there's all these people in the room. I don't know a single soul. But funny enough, I know a bunch of people now who were in the room that same day, which is just funny as to how God works like that. But I'm walking down the aisle, and I see this huge black dude walking towards me. Now, I've met Eric Mason a few times. He's not that big, but that day, he was 6'8", 420 pounds in my eyes. He had these two big earrings in his ear, a t-shirt that said, "Suck My Kicks," one of the Nike shirts, Jordans, sagging jeans, and I'm like, and he looks at me, and Eric Mason's got this big, gruff voice. And he looks down, and he goes, "What's up, young boy?" And I cowered. I was like, nothing. And just like slid into a seat and hid. And so the day starts off, and we start with worship. And Leah Smith was the worship leader at the time. Phenomenal singer. I grew up in an old Caribbean church. So her musical style was just something I had never heard before. And she's singing, and I'm like, this is wonderful. I'm going to take this back to my church. It's so cool. So after that, they're like, all right, before we start, we're going to have Eric Mason come up, and he's going to talk about Christology, why Jesus is central. So this guy gets up, and I'm like, well, that can't be the pastor, not him, looking like that. He spoke for 15 minutes about why Jesus is central. And in those 15 minutes, I took more notes than I had ever taken in my life. And I was like, all right, this is cool. So after that, I go to hermeneutics, the art of interpreting scripture, a word I had never heard before, with this guy, Matt Chandler. Now,
wow.
Matt Chandler is the 6'4 gangly white dude. And this was Matt Chandler post-brain surgery. So he's got the bald head, big scar. And I think to myself, the big black guy scared me, but I'm not going to let this lanky white guy scare me. That's not going to happen. Matt Chandler starts speaking. And if you ever get to hear him speak in an intimate setting, he's such a dynamic speaker. You just feel small in your seat. So after that, I go to Bible study methods with Eric Mason, and I'm thinking to myself, because I'm a closet nerd, so all of this learning was so dope for me. I was taking in so much, and I had grand plans and ambitions to take this stuff back to my church. Penal substitutionary atonement? I had never heard that before. I'm like, this is going to be great. So right before
CJ, not to interrupt you real quick. So do you mind? So that's a big word that you just used, right? Like substitutionary atonement. Like what were you used to hearing? And what was so life-changing to hearing that?
What I was used to hearing was Jesus died for you. And that's what penal substitutionary atonement means. But for me, being the closet nerd that I am, getting this big phrase put together, it just hit differently. It just sounded so smart. It's what they were preaching at my church all these years. I just didn't have ears to hear it.
Yeah, good. Gotcha.
So Matt Chandler comes up, and this is the end. Matt Chandler comes up and he says, you know, everything that we did here today was great, but we need to know why we do what we do. It is who Jesus is and what he has done. And he lays out the gospel. God, man, Christ response. God created man. Man sinned. Jesus came to bridge that gap between man and God. Our response is wholehearted faith and trust in him. And I was like, yeah, right on. And then Matt goes, you're not a Christian because you grew up in church. You're not a Christian because your parents are Christians. You're not a Christian because of your activity. You're not a Christian because it's the best option amongst the many. You're not a Christian. He just kept naming all of the reasons that I would have given you for why I am a Christian. And he stops and he goes, we are Christians because of who Jesus is and what he has done. And it was in that moment that the Holy Spirit opened my eyes and showed me that I had been living a lie. That the reason I couldn't get my life together, the reason that I couldn't stop with my pet sins, the reason that I was living in such guilt and shame was because I had been trying to do it all in my own strength. I had boiled Christianity down to flipping a light switch on and doing better. And the gospel of Jesus Christ is that he was perfect, so I don't have to be. And what he requires in return is my wholehearted trust, obedience, and faith in him. And that was it. That was the life-changing message right there.
Wow. That's powerful. Like, I feel like I could just play that for everybody listening like 100 times over. Like, hey, you need to hear the gospel? Listen to this. CJ, that was an amazing kind of story of how God sort of saved you even though you thought you might have been saved kind of thing. And so what's different about this time after this conference that didn't happen before when you thought the light switch went on, but this time it seems like it really went on? What did life look like after that?
Man, well, life was radically transformed. My mind was blown. Now, you don't unlearn 22 years of bad behavior overnight. So it was definitely a journey and a process. One that I'm still on. I am, as of last month, I'm 9 years into this thing, but I know that I'm not who I was a decade ago. And that's incredible. So immediately after that, the first thing I do is I download every single sermon that was available from Epiphany Fellowship and the Village Church. And between the two of them, it was about 10 years worth of sermons.
And that Epiphany Fellowship is Eric Mason, right?
That's Eric Mason's church, yeah, in Philly. So between the two of them, it's about 10 years worth of sermons. And every day I think it took me about 8 months to get through it, I had an hour drive to work, 8 hours at work, an hour drive home. I just listened to sermons all day. And then sometimes at night, if there was nothing on TV I wanted to watch, I'd play some 2K on my Xbox and I'd listen to more sermons. And I was learning so much. I was learning the implications of the gospel. I was learning what it means to live in light of the resurrection, to live in light of Jesus dying and rising on your behalf, of what it truly means to be a Christian. So all of the do's and don'ts that I got growing up, I was starting to understand the why behind them.
So is that the key? Is that the key that's sort of changing your mind, like kind of blowing your mind at this point? Is the why behind the things you've heard before? Is that sort of the game changer that I can imagine you like playing 2K and like listening to this sermon and being like, because I know I do it when I listen to like, you know, either one of those guys, but just the idea of like, wow, that was so good. Like, what are those moments that are making you say, wow, that is so good, or that's so crazy, or that's so different than what I, you know, what are those moments or those things that are kind of changing your mind?
I don't even know what it was exactly at that point, but it was those two guys are hard hitters. They're coming at you directly. They are coming at you unapologetically with the gospel, with the truth of Jesus. And I love that they're both so direct. And they were just hammering the truth home. Like Eric Mason did a series through Ephesians, and it was the passage Ephesians 5:1-10, and it was about the newness of life. And because Philly's only an hour and a half away, in those first 2 or 3 years, I would pop down to Epiphany Fellowship every couple of months just because I missed it so much. And I happened to be in the building for that particular message, and I brought a bunch of friends with me. And he had this line that just hit so hard. He said, at some point, you have to want to change. You know, you you've been changed by the gospel. It's wrecked you. It's changed your life. But you're still living the old way. Then did it really change you? You can't just be struggling with this thing forever. Like on some level, you got to want it. And I don't know why, but that hit me in my soul because I was still wrestling with a lot of the same sins and I was feeling guilty and I was saying, oh, I can't stop or I'm trying to stop, but it's just not working. And when he said, you just have to want to change, I was like, yeah, you are right. And it was things like that that were such game changers for me.
And so to kind of like a question that I feel like I definitely didn't prep you for any of these questions. So if it's it might be a little bit out of left field, but something I immediately think when I hear this is just how different sometimes the church culture is than exactly what you're saying, right? Because I have a similar story where I grew up in the church and it was hard hitters like you're talking about that really like made me go, wow, finally, the line I remember thinking is, Jesus wasn't really worth my time until I heard sermons like this, where I was like, dang, I have to respond. Like, I didn't have a choice. Yeah. Like, before I could, I kind of thought of Jesus, like, growing up in the church as like, all right, I'll get there, and he's like an old, you know, nice guy, and so, like, I'll get there, and I'll be able to, like, convince him that I wasn't that bad, and he'll go, all right, fine, and let me in. So, like, he's not worth my time. But when you hear the Jesus that you know, Matt and Eric are talking about, immediately are like, I don't get that ability to just sort of like, whatever. Like, I have to decide. I have to make a decision. This Jesus demands it. And so does it kind of – what are your thoughts on the church that I feel like is so fluffy and so sort of doesn't have that hard-hitting thing because they think they're saving people that way, but it's actually the very thing they need? Does that make sense? Like, that's what changed you.
Yeah, I think a part of it is – it's the fact that American Christianity, it doesn't cost you anything. It doesn't really cost you anything to be a Christian here. And so we're constantly in this place of trying to woo people in. How can I have the most programs? How can I have the most appealing message? How can I have the new thing that's going to draw people in? But the gospel is the same gospel that's been saving people for 2,000 years. It is that message of who Jesus is and what he's done. It's not your programs. I went to Dallas a couple of years ago, and I was astounded by the amount of mega churches. And my friend I was with said to me, she was like, yeah, if you don't like X about your church, church Y is like, hey, I got that and then some. And that's how they're drawing people in. It's not the message of the gospel. It's look at all the stuff I can do for you. Look at how good I can make you feel. Look at how I can get your kids out of your hair for 5 days a week.
It's tough. It's so tough because I'm an elder at my church, and it's like just that constant conversation of our pastor moved away and took another job, and so we went through like a pastor search, and I remember as an elder just constantly navigating through this question in my head of leading the people based on what they need versus based on what they want. Right. And so there was this constant desire of like, tell us, hurry, what's going on? Who's the next guy? Who are we hiring? And yet at the same time, like knowing in my heart of hearts what they needed to hear was Christ is in charge. He's always been in charge. And so set your minds not on who this next savior who's going to come and save our church. And just to like, hey, we're preaching the gospel and lives are being changed and show up again on Sunday. And we're going to keep preaching the gospel. And there'd be this like, okay, cool, that's, I get it, that's good, but like seriously, when's the next guy coming? You know what I mean? It's like that idea of like what people think they want versus what they actually need. It's such a difficult thing to navigate. Like I'm sure you guys dealt with it and deal with it in your own church now of like it's so easy to say that, it's such a harder thing to like live it out because man, it's so hard to trust in only the gospel or only Jesus. It's like, well, Jesus plus this event or plus this thing that we do as a church, that'll really be the game changer. Rather than the gospel just being enough.
Man, that is my everyday struggle. Yeah, every day, it's tough. Trying to remember that. Our hope is in him and him alone. It's not in the right situation. It's not in getting these boxes checked. It is purely in Jesus.
Yeah. Oh, man. CJ, this is the stuff that I think about every day. And I'm so glad that you worded it and explained it the way that you did because that idea of like, man, the thing you needed was someone to be bold and direct and honest with you, not for someone to coddle you, right? Yes. But yet, I would imagine that you would describe Matt and Eric as gracious and loving and caring. Like, you can be direct and you can be honest, you can be truthful, and you can still care for someone. Like, it doesn't have to be like one or the other. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's not an either or. I think sometimes the most gracious and loving thing you can do is be direct with a person.
No, it's exactly right.
And I think we miss that. I think too often we think being direct is harsh or it's bad or it's mean. And it's like, no, sometimes you just need the truth that isn't sugarcoated, and that's okay.
And I think I had some guys over to my house for Bible study a few nights ago, and something we were talking about is like part of the reason why we find that so difficult to hear, or we want to run from direct and honest, like, gospel, like, Christ is enough, like, we have no hope except for in Christ, that, like, honest, direct reality, is because we're worried that if we're honest and vulnerable, that, like, Christ will be a liar, and that, like, he won't actually, he'll go, ooh, that's your sin? Ugh, okay, no. I didn't really mean that whole, like, grace alone thing, because I didn't realize that your sin was that bad. Yeah. It's like, no. If we realize that the gospel is that big, we can be that vulnerable. We can be that honest about how bad our sin is, because Christ is actually enough, you know?
So true.
So to kind of go back to your story, because I totally interrupted you. So you're changed by this. You're driving up there to see this pastor. You're seeing Eric Mason. You're listening to the sermons. How does that start to take root in you and change how you think about church, how you do church, and kind of end up where you are today, where you're writing, speaking, all that kind of stuff?
Man, so you listen to these two guys talk enough, and there is undoubtedly the term church planting is going to come up. And so I start hearing about this church planting thing, and I'm like, yeah, somebody needs to plant a church in New York. Not me, but like somebody needs to, because we need churches here. And at the time, I was working in finance, and I was trying to decide between business school and seminary. And my dad says to me, he goes, well, if you go to seminary, then I'll pay for your first year, which he didn't do, but it was enough to make me say, I'll apply. So I applied to one school.
He didn't do, but it was enough
school
to get you going.
Yeah, I was like, you know, if that's the offer, why not try?
Yeah.
So I applied to one school, and I said, God, if this is what you have, then I make it happen. And I apply to the school and I get in. And I was like, oh, all right, well, I guess I'm going to seminary and I guess I'm going to plant a church. And so I'm being spiritually formed and I'm in seminary now and I'm ironing out my theology and I'm trying to figure these things out. And I'm still a spoken word artist. And through just, I hate to call anything random, because God is sovereign and what feels random turns out to be his plan. So I joined Twitter in 2009. I become a believer in 2010. And I want to say it was 2011 or 12. I want to say probably early 2012. I read this book called Lies My Pastor Told Me by a guy named Cole Brown, still one of my great friends to this day. This book, it basically takes all of these things we've heard in church growing up that are not biblically correct and explains why they're not. So things like, oh, I feel the Spirit moving. So Cole kind of walks through that. Well, what do you mean when you say that? What does the Bible say when the Spirit is moving? What's the evidence of that? So I read this book and I immediately find him on Twitter, because that's when you can make friends on Twitter. Twitter was a much different place back then.
And not as angry as it was today.
Yeah, it was a nice place. Twitter was a very friendly place in the beginning. So I hit him up on Twitter and I'm like, hey, your book was great. Really loved it. And we start to form this Twitter relationship. And we're going back and forth every couple of weeks or so. And then in mid-2012, August 2012, actually, to be exact, I do a show with Propaganda, the rapper, spoken word artist. And I'm opening for him. But in the meantime, I'm talking to his manager a lot. And I found out his manager lives in Portland. And I'm like, oh, Portland, do you know Cole Brown? He's like, Cole's one of my best friends. You should go work at his church. I'm like, yeah, okay, sure. And I'm a Brooklyn boy. What do I know about Oregon other than the Oregon Trail video game and the Blazers? But I hit Cole up. I DM him on Twitter. And I'm like, hey, I met Paul. And Paul said I should come work for you. And he's like, all right, well, answer some questions. And Cole is an amazing guy. I love him. He So we're emailing back and forth, and he's asking me about, like, who's my favorite wrestler. Like, these are his interview questions. And he's like, all right, you seem pretty solid.
Like, professional, like WWE wrestling?
Yeah, like WWE wrestling. And Cole will tell you to this day, Bret the Hitman Hart is the best there is, the best there was, and the best there ever will be. He was my childhood hero, will always have a special place in my heart. So I go out in September. I fly out on a Thursday. I land Thursday morning. And the moment I get off the plane, I'm like, yeah, this is where I should be. So Cole and I hang out all weekend. I get to meet the people at the church. And I'm like, all right, I'm moving to Oregon. So I moved to Portland. And I intern at his church for a little bit. I finish up seminary at Western out there. I'm there for a year. And then I move back to New York. I get married. I'm still in finance. And from there, yeah, so that brings us to 2014. And then in 2015, I started working at the short-term missions organization. But for the last 7 years now or so, I've been wrestling with this idea of church planting. And should I do this? Should I not do this? And the freedom I've experienced in Christ, particularly in the last 4 months or so, is I think there's a very clear call to pastoral ministry on my life. If you ask my grandmother, she would have told you that when I was two. so it's just coming to fruition now. But I think in our church circles, we often limit being a pastor to you have to plant a church. And in the last 4 months, I'm just experiencing the freedom of, no, that's not the only way. You can take on a job at a church that's already there. You can be a lay elder. You can be an associate, all these different things. And so now where I am is, I think I've nestled comfortably into this place of writing and speaking, and I've been really enjoying going to colleges, going to churches, talking about justice and the gospel. I got to do the Crew Fall Retreat in the Midwest this year, and I got to spend 3 days walking with college students through the book of Ephesians, and it was so life-giving and so beautiful. And I'm not completely ruling pastoring off the table, but right now it's just, where is God leading? What's he pointing me to? What does he want me to do? And just being completely open to that.
That's powerful. So it seems like your ministry and the call in your life, pastoral, planning a church, all that kind of stuff, it is finding itself in your writing as well, because I've really seen some of your writing online and enjoyed a lot of it. And so how did that talent of yours, it's obviously a talent, you're an extremely gifted writer. Thank you. How did that sort to grow? I know you've always been doing the poetry stuff, but like, how did you even, I'm looking at an article right now on the Gospel Coalition, so how are you even getting these kind of like opportunities? Are you just writing and people are picking it up, or how are you kind of honing that skill, I guess?
I can't remember where I saw the quote, but it was like, if you want to be a good writer, write more. So remember that writing class I told you about that my mom put me in at 13? Again, God, it's just God's sovereignty, how he works these things out. So I wrote poetry there, but we also just did a lot of prose writing and learning how to write, how to construct sentences and all these things. And when I was in Portland, I decided to stop doing spoken word because it was becoming too much like a job. For me, it was a hobby that blew up into this thing I never expected it to blow up into. But also knowing that I wanted to lean more towards being a pastor, I'm like, no one's ever going to invite me to come speak if all they ever know me for is spoken word. They're going to want that. That's what they're going to want to hear. So those factors led me to stop doing poetry. And I would start to write a little more just for myself, just kind of journaling or practice writing articles. And somewhere along the way, I think it was probably about 2 years ago, I said, you know, I want to write. If you had asked me when I was 10 what I wanted to do when I grew up, the answer was write and be left alone. And so writing had always been a passion of mine. And so I was like, you know, I want to start doing it again. So I just started writing. And I think it was The Witness that gave me kind of my first published piece. And I got connected with them through a friend of mine. And so it was through Cole. Cole connected me to The Witness. They were looking for someone to write about the intersection of Caribbean life and African-American life and what it looks like to straddle those fences. And lo and behold, my mom's from Trinidad and my dad's from Harlem. So it put me right into that vein. And so I started writing for them.
Yeah.
And then my church is an Acts 29 church. And I think that's how the Gospel Coalition found me, through them. And then Christ in Pop Culture, I saw they had something on Twitter. They were accepting pitches. And I was like, hey, I'll try. And I pitched an article. They liked it. And that eventually turned into this blossoming relationship. And so it's really just been a lot of God just kind of moving things and people my way and just giving me opportunity. And honestly, it's great editors. In every publication I get to write for, the editors are phenomenal. And they make me look a lot better than I actually am.
Man, honestly, I was actually hanging out with my wife before we got on the podcast, and I sent her it looks like one of your more recent articles about disconnecting from your cell phone and different things. And I sent it to her, and I said to my wife, I said, Courtney, I said, this is really well written. And I'm a writing snob. Like, I'm a reading snob. You know what I mean? Like, I'm the kind of guy that's like, yeah, great article, poorly written. Right, man, this guy's, and I'm not even that good of a writer, but I just feel like, I don't know. Some people are coffee snobs. I'm a writing snob. And so the fact that I was like, Court, she's like, wow, it must be good. I'm like, no, it's really well written. And even just the truth of it, the article was all about, I guess it's like something you're doing, like disconnecting from your cell phone all day on Saturday, and just how quickly you notice, like, you talk about the phantom vibration. I mean, we all feel them. Man, my phone could be a million miles away. I'm like, did my phone just go off? It's like a, yeah, it's like a telepathic, like my phone's vibrating somewhere. I could feel it.
We all have the same phones now. So anyway, hear someone's chime and you're like, oh, that's me, right? That's me.
That's me, right? Yeah. It's crazy how, and this, you kind of talk about this in your article, like just how that becomes like almost an addiction, right? Like where we're kind of we feel this like endorphin run through our body when we hear that noise go off. Like, oh my gosh, who's reaching out to me? Who's connecting with me?
Yeah.
The article I'm looking at right now, actually on my end, is I think one of the ones I enjoyed the most was this idea of, does your church reach folks who don't look like you? And I want to kind of hear your thoughts on one of the lines you have in here. You say, be a church that seeks to actively engage the whole of your city, not just the people most like you. At our church in Brooklyn, we regularly encourage our members to join their neighborhood block associations and PTA boards and to spend time at local recreation centers. These are often places of neighborhood life, and getting involved provides opportunities to meet a wide variety of people. I think what was so powerful to me, where this sticks out, is because, man, that sounds like, you know, if I'm playing devil's advocate, it's like, man, CJ, that's a lot of work, right? Like, I just want to go to church, mm-hmm, believe the gospel, and, like, live my life. I don't want to have to, what's the word? I don't want to share life as well, right? And so how are you doing that in your church, and how do you deal with that rub of, like, man, when we're honest, that just sounds like a lot. So what would you say to someone who said that?
I would say this is the call that Jesus has placed on our lives. You go out and make disciples of all nations. There's an argument that could be made for Matthew 28 for that interpretation to be, as you are going, make disciples. So it's like, as you're living life, this is what you should be doing. So this shouldn't feel like some extra burden. This should feel like the call on your life. So where you work, are you talking to your coworkers about Jesus? The laundromat you go to, because this is New York, very few of us have washers and dryers in our apartments. Are you getting to know people there? I'm not asking you to go out of your way. I'm asking you to look at your life and see where you can start to share the gospel. So one of our lines in our church is, we are the saved and sent people of God. And then I like to borrow a line from Blueprint Church in Atlanta, where Dahadi Lewis says that we are simply trying to do ministry where life exists. So where does your life exist? I'm not asking you to go out of your way. I'm asking, where does your life exist, and how can you live as a saved and sent person of the Father?
So that line that you just said is so powerful. That idea of like doing ministry where you are, right? Like the idea of something I'm always fighting for on this podcast, and it's because it means so much to me personally. So I always imagined myself being in full-time ministry, and then here I am. I've been in business. So I'm kind of like the opposite of you. Like I was an accounting major in college, but also religion and philosophy major, and always thought, oh, I'm going to be in like vocational ministry. Not this finance stuff, and then here I am. I end up being in business stuff and not in vocational ministry or not in sort of ministry stuff. And so, I mean, I have obviously this business and this podcast and stuff like that, but just like more the business world that I've been living in. And so, for me, I read a book by Tim Keller, and I probably talked about it 1,000 times on the podcast. But the idea of it's a book called Every Good Endeavor, where he talks about everything you do being kind of this symbol and this fragrance of the gospel, right? And so, like, when you work well. When you care for your family, care for them in a way that points them toward Jesus. When you're in these neighborhood associations, you know, be a Christian and live out the gospel in light of everybody. And so, but I love the idea of even what your church is doing, what you're writing in this article, this idea of, like, go look out for these situations, right? Like, not only do them in the ones that you're already in, but there's this idea of, like, man, part of living the gospel is where can I be, like, where can I just serve? And not in the way of, like, let me go and, you know, stand on a street corner and, like, raise a sign that says Jesus loves you, but where can I just be in this life with people and live it out? And I think that's so powerful because it immediately makes everything spiritual, yeah. Right? The PTA board, it becomes something that you pray about before you go rather than just showing up, right? Like, it's like, it costs a lot, but man, that's where the joy is, yeah. Right? Like, that's where it all becomes real, at least for me.
Yeah, you're spot on. I think it causes you to live differently because now you're constantly living with the gospel on your mind and you're investing. I think we have a real problem with investment because me asking you to do ministry where life exists means that you can't just go and hand someone a tract and walk away. It means you have to take the time to get to know people, exactly. To know their struggles, to know their hurts, to know their barriers to the gospel. And you get to walk with them through that. There's nothing, there are few things that bring me more joy than having someone I've been talking to say, you know what, I get it now. I believe this gospel thing, it's taking root in my heart. Like, how can, like, that, like, that gets me up in the morning. That gets me excited.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And I think too, like, something for people to hear, and I'm assuming that you agree with this, just the idea of, like, just because we can talk about it so passionately and excitedly doesn't mean that we don't have days and moments and minutes and hours of overwhelmed by the weight of it or feeling, you know, discouraged or feeling like you just said, like, when someone says to you, I get it now, man, how many conversations did you have with them before they said that?
Yes.
Where you left and thought, what the heck, man, what, is this doing anything? Like, why am I doing this? But just the idea of, like, there are not these, the gospel does not have these, like, short little, like, things that you do and then automatically everything gets better, right? You pray a prayer, you're saved, now everything's good, just go do whatever you want. It's like, it is this long journey of obedience, right? This long, daily, everyday walking towards Jesus. And it costs a lot, but man, it's like I think about Peter when Jesus tells the rich young ruler to, like, sell everything he has and give it to the poor. And Peter basically says to him, well, we've given up everything. And Jesus looks at him and is like, yeah, and you'll be rewarded for that. Like, there is a reward. I'm not asking you to, like, just, like, give everything. The reward is you get me, right? Like, you don't get riches. You don't get, you know, it's not like everything will be perfect, but you get me at the end of this. Yeah. It's just powerful stuff. Kind of to wrap everything up, CJ, what's something that the Lord's kind of put on your mind and heart recently that you think, you just think that the Lord's teaching you that you would want to, like, share with people, that you're like, man, this is what the Lord's really been kind of, like, speaking to me.
Man, it is trusting and waiting on Him. I struggle so hard with contentment. I grew up pretty poor. I grew up not having a lot. I grew up with a lot of my life being no. And when your life has been a series of no, sometimes you just want to get some yeses. And the difficulty in that is it breeds a lack of contentment. Because for me, there's never enough. It always feels like I'm trying to make up for lost time, or I'm trying to cover some ground, or I have kids now. I have a year and a half old daughter, and I've got a daughter on the way. And a lot of what I think about is I don't want them to struggle in the same ways that we had to struggle. I want to give them a better life than what I had. And I have a better life than what I had, but I can't say I fully have the life I want. And so it's constantly looking at the next thing. What's next? I wrote 15 articles last year. Can I get 25 this year? Or I got 5 speaking engagements last year. Can I get more? I'm looking to make a certain dollar amount so that I can take care of my family. And it's like you're constantly chasing the rabbit. And I'm kind of at a crossroads in my life right now where I don't know what's next. And my wife and I, we've been praying through a lot of things and just trying to trust God on, you know, on him doing what he does, just coming through. And that waiting period when you struggle with contentment can be so hard. And I'm reading the book of Nehemiah right now. And one of the things that I like to do as I read scripture in my time is I read, I've been reading a commentary with it. So I've been reading the Bible Speaks Today commentary because I'm trying to, you know, amass this beautiful collection of all of the Bible Speaks Today commentaries. And so I'm in Nehemiah and I'm flipping to it now. I'm reading this morning and this line just jumped out at me where the Raymond Brown is the commentator, where he says, waiting time is not wasted time. And that line, it broke me this morning. So I read when I get to work in the morning, just kind of take half an hour or so, and I read and I pray. And my staff happened to come into the office early. And so I'm reading this, and I've got some worship music playing in the background, and I've got tears streaming down my face. And they're all like, what's going on right now? And I'm like, I'm having a moment. But yeah, just that waiting time is not wasted time. And he just talks a lot about Nehemiah's dependent prayer and deliberate planning. And so my prayer the last few weeks has been, God, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know what the next step is. I know I'm stressed out, but I also know that you are bigger than my stresses. And so I'm going to use the gifts and the talents that you've given me, and I'm just going to go. And you're going to do what you do, and I'm going to trust you. I think about David's words. I've been young and I've been old, and I've never seen the righteous forsaken or begging for bread. And when I look back over my life, I can see how he has moved and shifted things and how he has used pain to ultimately bring triumph. I can see everything that I thought was bad being used for good and how it all ended me where I am today. So if there's anything that I can leave people with, it is to know that Paul wasn't lying in Romans 8 when he said all things work together for the good of those who love him. I am living proof of that. And I think that when we look back on our lives, when we see where he's brought us from, we can all attest to that.
Boom. Wow, that was super powerful. That idea of, man, it is no wonder why you were tearing up in your office, right? Like, that's the idea of, like, things will not be perfect in this life. There will be hard times, and the waiting is hard and difficult. I was talking to those same guys the other night at a Bible study, and this reality that I was showing them was like, I don't think that at the end of Job's life, after all that suffering, but because he saw God in this new, powerful way at the end, that if you walked up to him at the end of his life and said, if you could do it all over again, and God gave you the choice of no suffering, but you don't see him in that way, what would you take? He's like, oh, obviously I take the suffering. I take the waiting. I take the brokenness and all of it, because you just see God differently at the end of that waiting season, at the end of that. And it redeems all that craziness leading up to it, that Job would have looked at you and laughed and said, no way. Like, give me whatever, right? I want to see God like I saw him there. And so, no, that's so powerful, CJ. Thank you so much for that truth. And so, where could people find you? If people listening are like, wow, I've loved everything this guy has said. I want to read more from him. I want to hear him speak at my college. I mean, where can they find you?
Twitter and Instagram, same handle, CJ_Quartlebaum, QURTLBAUM.com. CJ_Quartlebaum. And then my website is CJQuartlebaum.com.
Cool. That is awesome. Guys, go check out CJ. His writing's amazing. I haven't listened to you, but I just talked to you on the podcast. I'm imagining your speaking is as good. So, CJ, thank you so much for being on the podcast. It really honestly was a pleasure. I'd love to have you on again one day and just keep dropping crazy lines like that whole waiting is not wasted. I love that one. Cool. Thank you so much, CJ. It was really an honor to have you on the podcast. Thanks for having me. All right, guys, another episode in the books. Hope you enjoyed it. Hope it pushed you towards Jesus. I'm really thankful for CJ for being on the podcast, taking time out of his day to do that. And again, with every one of these podcasts, we really, really hope that it pushes you towards Jesus. If you like it, please subscribe, review it on iTunes, share it with your friends, with your homies. But yeah, just seriously, I hope that it encouraged you to follow Jesus in a way that you might not be doing it right now, right? Don't settle for something less than. Jesus is better. So keep seeking him, keep pressing in. Give up on kind of the trivialities of this life and just trust in him. So yeah, guys, hope you enjoyed it. Look forward to the next one. Again, review it, subscribe, share it with friends. It means a lot to us. All right, guys, keep seeking Jesus.